It's too early to know how deep or wide, but we're almost certainly in a recession. Texas's top money official, Comptroller Glenn Hager, on the R Word. That's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. New jobless claims today underscore the gut punch to the economy. The Comptroller General recalculates the impact of COVID-19 on our bottom line. Also, tech expert Omar Gayaga on getting and keeping your internet access during a time of extreme use, speaking of. A hot tip for movie streaming, an almost forgotten Texas film that inspired a certain festival called Sundance. It's the whole shoot and match and then some today on the Texas Standard. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. They are businesses old and new. They are veteran workers and recent hires. They are people who are familiar with unemployment benefits and people who swore they would never take public assistance. None of these distinctions seem to matter anymore. The latest numbers from the Labor Department indicate that 16.8 million Americans have lost their jobs in a span of just 3 weeks. That's a greater number of job losses than we witnessed in 2 years of the Great Recession. There is simply no precedent for this drop off the economic cliff and no way to know what's on the other side. But there is general agreement that sugarcoating it won't make the landing any softer. The Texas Workforce Commission reports that 700,000 Texans have filed unemployment claims since the start of this crisis. But that's almost certainly low since businesses are still closing, people are still getting laid off, and many Texans still can't get past jammed phone lines or complete claims online. Indeed, those jobless claims are overwhelming a computer system with a backbone designed sometime in the 1980s, the Houston Chronicle reports. And this at a time when state agencies are being warned they'll need to start dialing back things like equipment upgrades and putting on hold planned expansions. Why? Well, because there may not be the money for it. It's the job of the state controller to keep up with Texas finances and advise state officials on money matters, but the inevitable lag in data makes it even harder to make definitive statements about the health of the economy or its future. Texas Comptroller Glenn Hager, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Always good to be with you.
It's been a couple of weeks since we last spoke. At the time, you definitely were warning to batten down the hatches. How bad is it now, and are you using that R word?
Well, unfortunately, I do believe that not just Texas, the U.S., but the globe, the entire world is in a recession right now. You know, unfortunately, this pandemic, plus, unfortunately for Texas, added on to that is an oil price war that's going on, which has suppressed oil prices and badly impacted the oil and gas industry, which is very important to the state of Texas. But overall, so many businesses are being shut down, more so from the pandemic. So we've never really seen anything of this magnitude so quickly. Mm-hmm. Yet again, you know, I firmly believe, obviously, the Texas economy had a very strong base. We've got a lot of different tools in our toolbox for state government to try to deal with this, the budgetary issues that are coming. And so, you know, we've faced downturns before, and I feel very strongly that we're going to get over this one, as we have those in the past. But, you know, we don't know the exact impact of how deep or how wide it is right now, just because, as you mentioned on the introduction, you know, we just don't really have good data. You know, we have also an economic stabilization fund, which is also known as the rainy day fund, one of the largest fund balances of all the 50 states. So we're very blessed to have that. That is another tool in the toolbox. So my point is, we're going to have to use a whole lot of different of these tools, as we have in the past. You know, when I was a state legislator, I served in 2003 when we had a significant budget cut downturn, 2011 when we had a significant budget downturn. And so I've seen several of these before. That's why I've instructed my agency. We are being much more strategic in our hires. We're going to cut back on our hiring practices. We're also, you know, implementing freezes and pay increases. We're looking at IT projects that we can postpone that we don't have to do today. Yeah. Just different mechanisms that anybody would do in their own business or household to be able to reduce expenditures and start thinking longer term, because it's better to think longer and shallower if you can make the cuts than waiting and waiting and say, oh no, we need to do something now.
Do you have a sense of what agencies could take the biggest hits ultimately? I mean, is there any way of knowing that?
Well, I think obviously it needs to be spread across. The wider you can spread it, you know, obviously that's shallower for everybody, which a lot of times, you know, in all of these, always what you do is you exempt the foundation school program, which essentially means public education. Mm-hmm. You also exempt Medicaid, children's health insurance program, those entitlement programs, mm-hmm. which if you add all those up, that's about 2/3 of the state budget.
Right.
And so therefore, the point being is, a lot of the cuts get put on a lot of the business functions of the state. And so when the economy gets back going, it's really critical that those employees are there. You can make sure to process paperwork and permits and tax ID numbers, all of the things that businesses need immediately to get back going. So my point mm-hmm. being is, you know, you need to think about it very strategically, because we want those businesses to be able to get back to going and hiring their employees and everybody making sure the Texas economy is back going as strong as we can when we get past the social distancing.
Now, speaking of that, and I know these are all kind of intricately intertwined here, but for instance, you know, there are a lot of businesses out there hurting. A state income tax deferral, a lot of those businesses might welcome. That would, I presume, require a special legislative session, unless I'm overlooking something there. Well, what about deferring a state income tax, and what about a special legislative session?
So, you know, for in Texas, since we don't have a state income tax, but we do have a franchise tax tax,
right.
which is on businesses. And so I have already delayed the filing of those returns and postpone those to match up with what the federal government did for income tax returns. And many other states are doing this because they have income taxes, and since we don't. And so instead of having those reports coming in and due coming this month, we have delayed those to July. And so therefore, you know, we're trying to work with businesses when it comes to sales tax or other types of taxes that are collected from you and I mean, they're held in trust. Those businesses then remit them to us. We're expecting those businesses to pay those taxes, file the reports. However, you know, there are certain unique circumstances where we will work with them on a very short-term basis, because again, it is collected from me and you and held in trust to be able to send to the state government.
Right. So let's get to that special legislative session. Do you think that that's going to be necessary to deal with some of these financial issues?
You know, Texas, whether it's the governor, lieutenant governor, the speaker, they have the ability to move money around as they're doing it to provide to the agencies that need increased resources to fight this pandemic, mm-hmm. and they're doing that. They also have the ability to instruct agencies to reduce their expenditures. They have a lot of different things they can do that we don't have to be in a legislative session. And so what's most importantly is the state of Texas can cash flow. I have the ability to make sure we're able to pay the bills, keep the lights on.
Right.
And so therefore, with the Economic Stabilization Fund, I don't see a need that the legislature needs to come back in session this calendar year, mm-hmm. because in fact, they're going to be back in session in January of 2021.
Right.
And so we have a lot of different mechanisms to where we can deal with these issues without the legislature having to be in session. And I don't see a need for them to come in session in the next couple of months.
What did that include? Let's say if you wanted to use some of that rainy day fund that you were talking about earlier, I think, what is it, like $10 billion in there with $2 billion earmarked for Harvey? Is that right?
That's right. So it has a little over $10 billion, and a little over $2 billion is still was appropriated but has not been drawn down. It was mostly Hurricane Harvey related type expenses. We will be making an additional deposit into that fund after this fiscal year closes, before the end of this calendar year of 2020. Mm-hmm. And so I expect when the legislature comes back into session, that fund will have probably every bit of about $8.5 billion or a little bit more in there, which is a significant amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, you know, the legislature, I'm able to use those dollars if I need to for cash flow purposes.
Right.
For example, when we start in September, October, and November, we send the school districts 50% of their money from the state side. And so there's a lot of expenses going out the door from the state side of it. And I may have a mismatch of expenditures and revenue coming in. So I may use, you know, other accounts that we have in the Treasury. I may use the Economic Stabilization Fund. So my point is, you know, I can use those to help bridge any mismatch of revenues
right.
through the fall, like we've done in the past, but the fund will be there in essence for the legislature to use if they need any of it come January, because they have to take an active vote, both the House and the Senate, with a two-thirds vote to be able to use any of those dollars. It's a very high threshold, but we've used it in the past during economic downturns, and I expect they will probably use it again.
Before I let you go, just one quick question about your own sort of thinking on the health of Texas financially. Are you more pessimistic, more optimistic? Where are you sort of feeling right now, especially with all these data points that are still open?
Well, I know that we've been through past events, and we're going to get through this one as well. Unfortunately, I'm not as optimistic as I was just literally 30, 45, 60 days ago. You know, back in February, the Texas economy was extremely strong. However, things changed very rapidly as we're fighting this pandemic. And so I know that we have several storms on the horizon that we're going to have to get through. We have headwinds in the Texas economy right now, where just 60 days ago it was a tailwind. You know, that has changed because of this pandemic. But I am optimistic in knowing that it's a strong state. We're going to get through this. It's going to be very rough, but we're going to get through it one more time.
Glenn Hager is the Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts. Comptroller, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Always good to be with you. Thank you.
Well, Zumbar, I think the thing that struck me the most when he was talking about the situation was how much things have changed just in a matter of a couple of weeks. This has been such a precipitous fall right off the cliff when it comes to unemployment, when it comes to the impact on businesses in Texas. And we haven't even really touched on the impact of what's happening with the oil industry right now. So it is a true economic storm.
A true sea change seemingly overnight. And as you mentioned, another Thursday here. So that brings a staggering set of unemployment figures, 6.6 million filing nationally this week, bringing the total to nearly 17,313,000 Texans filing last week. We've been asking our friends and listeners if they're affected, and here's what they're telling us. Queen of Sword, she tweets us that they are, and her bank is doing nothing to help with the Paycheck Protection Program business loan they're seeking, echoing a common complaint we've been seeing on social media, problems with applying for that program. On the Texas Standard Facebook page, Kim Nahara says the economic pain for many is the worst part of social distancing. Please help us recover, she says. You know, David, we're also seeing lots of reaction to another issue prompted by the pandemic, the prospect of voting by mail for future elections. Yes, President Trump has been pushing back hard against the prospect of voting by mail amid the coronavirus crisis, claiming without evidence that the process is extremely vulnerable to fraud. We've been reaching out to our friends and listeners via social media for their perspectives on that, and boy, are we seeing a lot of reactions already via Twitter, Facebook, and elsewhere. So I'll be back with some of those reactions later in the show.
Let us know about your reaction to that issue or anything else that's on your news agenda wherever you are in Texas. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. Our social media editor will be back with more of the talk of Texas in about 35 minutes or so. Stay with us as The Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. School closures across Texas have left many students missing the people they're used to seeing each day. This sudden shift can be extra difficult for some students with disabilities. Learning social skills and being included as much as possible in mainstream classrooms is a key part of special education, one that's hard to replicate through online learning. Houston Public Media's Laura Isensee has more on how these students and their parents are coping.
At Pin Oak Middle School, Elise Frio gets intensive reading instruction. She's 13 years old, in sixth grade, and has Down syndrome. While her mom, Jane Frio, says she's made a lot of progress, Elise still reads somewhere on a second grade level. Keeping up with reading isn't what worries her mom the most, though, with school closed.
People give her energy. You know, saying hi to people in the hallway and eating lunch with friends is as important to her as it, you know, as learning is to me, you know, like this, the social piece.
Elise is very extroverted and loves to interact with classmates in theater and dance. She's quick to list off her friends from lunch.
Audrey, Lexa, me, and Abby, me.
The coronavirus outbreak has put that social piece to her education on hold. It's a serious issue for thousands of students with disabilities in Texas. For many of them, socialization can be so important, it shows up in their individualized education programs. Those are legally binding documents between schools and parents that guide students' services and progress. Kristen McGuire is with the Texas Council of Administrators of Special Education. She says socialization can look different for kids of different ages. Take older students who are transitioning from school to the real world.
Socialization becomes part of, you know, how they get along with others and get along with supervisors, coworkers, you know, landlords.
She says some of that socialization can be moved online, like group meetings with counselors, but not all of it.
It's not just about academics. It's about learning how to interact with people. It's about finding friends. And I think that not having that is such a hard lesson at this point.
It's a lesson the Rodriguez family in San Antonio is figuring out as best they can. Erin Rodriguez says early on during the pandemic, she saw jokes about social distancing on Facebook. Things like,
oh my gosh, I've been training for this my whole life. Like, I'm on the autism spectrum or something. Like, this is so easy.
But she says it's not that easy for her three sons. They're all autistic.
Really, school is a great way for them to work on socialization and all that. So to not have school now is really isolating and really, it's just a whole different experience.
They've tried to connect in other ways. Her middle son, Frankie, who's 16, has spent a lot of time on the piano. He and his bandmates hung out in a video chat too. Her youngest son, Ricky, who's 10, has seen friends on Zoom and plays some with their younger sister. Her oldest, Tony, is a senior and is coming to terms with the fact graduation will probably be online.
I feel like I probably miss, like, the interaction with, like, especially with, like, my teachers and my classmates and stuff. Like, being at home, you don't really get much of that anymore.
In Houston, Jane Frio says her daughter Elise recently saw a friend in real life. The two girls visited for a whole hour and hope to do that again.
We can maybe sit outside with your friends.
Oh, yeah. And Dorothy, too.
Yeah. But we can't sit too close, right?
Not until the pandemic is over. For now, they're talking from chairs 6 feet apart in the front yard. I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a health and safety-focused workers' compensation provider, reminding Texans that the best way to stick together right now is to stay apart. More at texasmutual.com/coronavirus.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. How's that internet holding up for you? No, we're not just watching Netflix anymore. Now we, often the whole family at once, need to log on to live video streams, do research online, just stay in touch all day long as if we were in the office or on campus, right? And internet companies, well, some of them at least, are responding, some by waiving fees or offering enhanced services. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga joins us now with the scoop on how we can keep the bandwidth coming, even as we try to deal with all the dislocation. Omar, welcome back.
Hey, David, our connection is strong right now.
Yes, it does sound. I have to say, I've been marveling at the fact that I'm sure we've got all the ports plugged in right now, and we haven't had any major outages or any stammers or stutters. What are you hearing from listeners and people you're in contact with when it comes to the robustness of our internet service?
I think people are concerned that, you know, is all of this work from home and everybody online at the same time going to break the internet? And so far, it seems like it's held up. I've heard people say they're getting slightly slower connection speeds, but overall, it seems like we're doing okay. I haven't seen any major outages that have. I've seen some Google outages. Yesterday, my kids were booted off of Google Classroom, so there have been a few glitches, but overall, it seems like things are holding up.
You know, it's funny because I think all of us have seen the email messages from almost every company we've ever done business with, filling up our boxes with messages to let us know how they're responding to the coronavirus. A lot of these are kind of ignorable, but I wonder when your internet provider writes, maybe we should pay attention?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you get a message from your AT&T or your Spectrum or whatever saying, oh, we have an offer for you. It's like, yeah, no, that's okay. But I think right now, you might be missing on a discount that they're doing right now just because of COVID-19. You might be missing on waiving late fees or waiving any kind of billing that you might be behind on. So if you are struggling to pay your internet bill, I would definitely check in with your provider and see if they are offering any kind of payment relief or any kind of late fee waiving. And also we're seeing things like new accounts, like Spectrum is doing a thing where if you have a student who needs internet, they will provide a free 60-day initial internet access. The FCC has a kind of crisis $10 a month internet fee that they can give you to get internet if you're struggling. I think what we're really dealing with is a lot of digital divide issues, and some of these companies are reaching out to try to address that.
Yeah, the digital divide is a major issue, and certainly in a state as big as Texas. I know some school districts and governments have actually tried to create internet plans in response to the pandemic. Have you heard about some of this?
Yeah, I mean, just in Lockhart, Texas, I mean, they're doing a kind of a tower project to try to provide internet access to kids that don't have it. I mean, some of these school districts have homes where only maybe say 60% of the homes have, you know, robust enough internet access to do this kind of, you know, Zoom video chatting and class assignments online. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to find ways to get wireless internet access to these kids in other ways, and it might be, you know, parking a school bus with internet routers in it or putting up towers. A lot of school districts are trying to get creative about how do we get not just internet access but also devices to the kids that don't have them at home.
Do you get a sense that the internet companies themselves are able to increase service or provide additional service to households that might need it? I mean, I have heard of some folks who've said, listen, I actually feel like I need a dedicated line to get some of my work done.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have you know, who only do web browsing from home or only do, you know, Netflix and things like that have been able to get away with, you know, maybe wireless internet access or some sort of hotspot.
Right.
But I think as people are having to work from home and do video conferencing all day and things like that, I think people are starting to realize that, yeah, maybe I need to upgrade my account. By the same token, I think some people who don't need that or are furloughed or laid off right now and don't need that might want to think about downgrading their internet. If you have, you know, a $100 a month internet plan or something like that and you just don't need it right now, contact your ISP and get it downgraded to, you know, something much more affordable.
You can check out what Omar Gayaga is thinking about over at techminutetexas.com. That is, if you have the bandwidth. Thanks so much for getting us up to speed. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Stay safe. Appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine. Now more than ever, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments is critical. Learn more at TexasOncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A new lawsuit says Governor Greg Abbott exceeded his constitutional authority when he barred the release of certain inmates from local lockups. The Republican issued an executive order last month prohibiting people accused or previously convicted of violent crimes from getting out of jail without paying bail. David Donati is with the ACLU of Texas, which sued Wednesday.
What Governor Abbott has done is take away the discretion of judges and local communities to make decisions for themselves how they're going to respond to the COVID-19 disaster.
This is the second legal challenge Abbott is facing over the order. An emergency video meeting of major oil-producing countries today could have a big impact on how fast Texas oil producers bounce back from the economic downturn. The U.S., Saudi Arabia, Russia, and other nations are considering significant production cuts. That's because oil prices have floundered due to low demand during the pandemic and oversupply. The Texas fossil fuel industry could also get help from a bipartisan bill in Congress to buy $3 billion worth of U.S. oil for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Austin Republican Congressman Michael McCaul is co-sponsoring the legislation.
Energy being such a critical part of our economy, particularly in Texas, you know, it funds a lot of our universities, like the University of Texas and other ones, and we want to make sure that they stay in business through this crisis.
Other U.S. representatives from Texas sponsoring the bill include Democrats Lizzie Fletcher and Henry Cuellar. A Democratic congressman from Texas wants to ensure that undocumented immigrants are not left out of efforts to assist workers struggling due to the coronavirus outbreak. San Antonio Democrat Joaquin Castro, who chairs the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, discussed the issue during a virtual town hall Wednesday.
So one of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus's priorities is to continue to push to make sure every worker in American society, regardless of their immigration status, benefits from the relief packages that Congress is passing.
Elected officials in other parts of the country are tackling the issue as well. The mayor of Chicago this week issued an executive order to ensure undocumented immigrants could access the city's coronavirus relief benefits, such as housing assistance. The most populous county in Texas is joining others around the state in closing local parks for the Easter weekend to ensure compliance with social distancing protocols. Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo said it was not an easy decision.
I love all our parks. That is the respite. That is my solace, is for me personally to be able to go for a run at our parks. And so it's going to be hard for me, but it's something we have to do.
Other areas closing parks for the weekend include San Antonio and Austin. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. A Texas prison correctional officer has died this week, as well as a prison inmate, after each tested positive for the coronavirus. This is prompting the state prison agency to lock down 15 prisons across the Lone Star State, where staff members and prisoners have been testing positive. Here to tell us more about this lockdown is Jeremy Diesel. He's the Director of Communications for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice based in Huntsville. Jeremy, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Of course, David.
15 prisons in Texas locked down. What does lockdown entail exactly? What does that mean?
Well, lockdown's exactly what you might think it would be. It's a physical lockdown where offenders are in their cells with complete movement restrictions, no going to the day room, no going to the dining halls, meals are delivered to them in their cells, and all of that's obviously to limit offender movement as much as possible to stop any potential spread of this virus.
What about staff? You keep staff at the prison, I would imagine.
Yes, staff have been maintaining their presence at the prisons throughout. Visitation was halted back on March 13th when Governor Abbott issued his first order. And within 2 days of that order, we had established protocols where any staff entering units were temperature checked. If they had a temperature above 100.4 degrees, they were not allowed onto the unit. We also instituted those same temperature checks for any intake offenders coming into the units. We have now, with these lockdowns, three different levels of medical restriction that we're following closely. Those policies were developed in close coordination with the Centers for Disease Control and their specific guidelines to the unique nature of correctional facilities.
Well, I was just wondering, I mean, because you have people who are going to have to interact, even if just to give food, for example, to inmates, how do you keep them from spreading the virus to their own homes when they're off duty?
It's actually the bigger risk is the other way around. The prison environment is initially safe and clean and free of the virus. And if it's going to be brought into the prison system, it's going to come in from the outside. So that's always been our point of focus. Over the last week, we've made within TDCJ and distributed more than 70,000 cotton masks as prescribed by the CDC. All staff now that are entering or interacting with anyone on any of the prison units or facilities around the state, as well as parole officers who are interacting with parolees in the general public, are all required to wear those cotton masks. Again, as the CDC says, the point of a cotton mask is not to protect the person wearing the mask from someone else,
right,
but to protect someone else from the person wearing the mask. Now, we also have medical restriction, which is in offenders who have been in contact potentially, according to a contact investigation, with someone who has either tested positive or has a pending test for COVID-19, anyone engaging in close contact with those offenders has been wearing N95 mask and glove PPE. And then we also have medical isolation, which is the next step beyond that, which is those offenders who may have a pending test or have tested positive for COVID-19, and any interaction in close quarters with those offenders is using full PPE, which is mask, glove, gown, and eye protection.
So you have a full system set up there in the prison, but you know, some of these prisons, some of these facilities are in communities that are smaller and sometimes more rural, where you don't have a big healthcare system set up just around the corner or just down the road. How are you working with some of these local officials, and are you concerned about the possibility that if you do have an outbreak at one of these facilities, you know, how do you cope with it?
Well, we certainly have contingency planning to be able to handle that internally should we need to. The way that the virus has progressed and the way that this outbreak has progressed, both in the general community and within the prison system, they're sort of a mirror image of each other, except for the fact that within the prison system, we're seeing less cases per capita. But our initial cases, all of that testing and all of the medical treatment was essentially being done in outside medical facilities, whether our own hospital unit at Hospital Galveston or community hospitals in areas around our units, as you suggest. Now that's been consolidated where all of the testing that's being done connected to TDCJ is being done by the University of Texas Medical Branch. And there are levels and abilities for care. For example, we have a regional medical facility that's on one of our prison units here in the Huntsville area that has the ability to do all the way up to critical care. Hospital Galveston is obviously a full-scale hospital. It's actually a floor within John Seeley Hospital down in Galveston. So we have a pretty extensive healthcare network through our correctional managed healthcare partners.
Jeremy Diesel is Director of Communications for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Jeremy, thanks so much for taking a couple of minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Of course. I hope you have a great day.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Even during a pandemic, boots reflect the Texas spirit, that can-do spirit, the one that says the rougher the job, the better to have boots. As boots are such a part of Texas, we have a whole segment dedicated to them. We call it From Heel to Toe.
My name is Brandon Platino with Prime Cuts Tree Service, and I'm going to tell you how boots help in my job. First and foremost, protection. And safety of your ankles, heels, toes, I mean, from the chainsaw, from branches falling, from any other unforeseen hazards, really. So you can't come to work without work boots on. Don a good attitude, any other appropriate safety gear, and the job entails really just caring for trees and the flora. So it's kind of a nice, relaxing job, really. And you could say it's almost more of a hobby, except they get paid for it. Climbing the trees. Well, first you got to throw your lasso up there and tie yourself a good tight line hitch if that's what you're climbing on, and you kind of hoist yourself up there. As far as climbing the tree, I mean, we've all climbed a tree once or twice before in our lives, so of course you got to be careful on some trees not to strip the bark off too much. I mean, you don't want to get too rough, and I've had people request that we don't wear shoes up there, but you know, that's just crazy, so obviously we passed that job up. Boots are important. Traction, everything else. Why else are they important? Well, they're looking damn good, really.
Brandon Platino, still hard at work during COVID-19. Stay safe, Brandon. How do your boots help you with your job? Send your thoughts our way, texasstandard@kut.org. As you look for something to stream these days after working from home, there's a lot of talk right now about an almost forgotten Texas gem. Why all the talk all of a sudden? Well, because it was featured in the latest issue of The New Yorker, that's for starters. According to Richard Brody, who writes about film for The New Yorker, this movie was so singular that when Robert Redford saw it screened at a festival in Utah back in the 70s, It inspired him to start up a little annual event known in the cinema world as the Sundance Film Festival. Perhaps you've heard of it. Richard Brody, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much, David. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you. So, yeah, you could say this was an influential film, maybe as influential as it was exceptional from what you write about this movie called The Whole Shootin' Match. Tell us a little bit about it, because I think a lot of our listeners, certainly I had never heard of this movie before reading your piece.
The Whole Shootin' Match is more or less the birth of the Austin cinema scene. Eagle Pennell made it at the age of 25 in 1977. He had a career making TV commercials before that and made a feature film for basically no money. Everybody worked for nothing. They scrounged up short ends of film, borrowed equipment, and because people had jobs during the week, they shot the film the classic way, weekends, from Friday night until, you know, dawn on Monday.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like an Austin production. I can tell you. It's how a lot of films, big films, were made here in Austin. You think of Richard Linklater, right, with Slacker and stuff. Was this an inspiration for him?
Richard Linklater and Eagle Pennell appeared together on a panel probably around 1990. Just to tell you, the information that I have about Eagle Pennell, since I'm not an Eagle Pennell scholar, there's a wonderful documentary by his nephew, Rene Pennell, and Claire Huey called The King of Texas, which I highly recommend. It's on YouTube. Rene Pennell put it up there himself.
So tell us a little bit about the film before we go much further here. It's shot in 16mm black and white, right?
Mm-hmm. 16mm black and white, simultaneously rough-hewn and exquisitely crafted. It's a film of magnificent lived-in performances. It stars two men, Lou Perryman and Sonny Carl Davis, as essentially the Laurel and Hardy of the outskirts of Austin.
You got to get your mind right. It's the first thing you got to do if you want to get somewhere, is get your mind right.
My mind ain't right, I guess, huh?
They are two kind of good-hearted ne'er-do-wells who are working hard as furniture haulers and garbage haulers and looking for one big payday. Lloyd, played by Lou Perryman, comes up with a fantastic invention that hits and doesn't hit. I don't want to spoil it. Great story. But it's a story of near success and poignant failure.
This is like the chinchilla business, Lloyd. How much do we lose on that one, huh? That was our program.
Oh, air conditioners.
I should be driving a chinchilla Cadillac by now. How about the frog farm? How much we drop on that one?
Well, now that was a case of getting in the market too late.
Too late.
Just
about
the same time we got in, the market fell out.
The flying squirrel, Floyd.
Well, this town didn't even have a mosquito fogger when we got them flying squirrels.
Lloyd and Frank are carousers. They drink heavily. They go out every night. Lloyd is unmarried, but Frank is married to a woman named Paulette, and played by Doris Hargrave, which doesn't stop him from running around. And the underlying notes of this movie are the endurance, the pain, the forbearance of Paulette in the face of Frank's cavalier misbehavior. And much of it is uproarious, and at the same time, there's a tremendous amount of pain in that uproariousness.
You know, I'm not a film scholar, so I don't know a lot of the names in the film business, but I'm surprised I've never heard of Eagle Pennell because he seems to have been such a master at what he did. Whatever happened to him?
Well, unfortunately, Eagle Pennell did not make the career that the extraordinary merit and extraordinary attention that his first film got. He got to go out to Hollywood. He got a deal in Hollywood. The problem was that he had a substance abuse problem, that he started using drugs in Hollywood, didn't stay there very long, came back and found himself in the grips of alcoholism, which more or less dominated the rest of his career and the rest of his life.
Do you think that the whole shoot and match is that it still serves as a sort of touchstone for independent film, or is it largely forgotten? What's your sense of that?
I think it depends on who you talk to. I know that there are certainly critics and movie lovers who have always held the film dear. The influence that the film has had has largely been subterranean until now, an influence obviously on the creation of Sundance, an influence on Richard Linklater, certainly an influence on other people in Austin who needed to be there in film circles, whether as directors of photography or props people. You know, the movie world is, in fact, a world, even very locally. Nobody makes the movie alone. The whole shooting match galvanized a community, brought people together who wanted to make a film in Austin. And even if Eagle Pinnell's career and life were truncated, that community clearly lives on.
Richard Brody writes about film for The New Yorker. We're going to have a link to his story about the movie The Whole Shootin' Match, which was made by Texas filmmaker Eagle Pinnell back in the 1970s, a movie that inspired, among other things, the Sundance Film Festival. Richard, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. It's a fascinating story, and I can't wait to look at the movie.
David, thank you very much. It's good to talk with you.
Well, unless you're a surgeon, you might not have heard of something called a containment box. It's like a clear box placed over a patient's head to protect health workers from like a sudden cough or sneeze when the patient's on the operating table. Well, a shortage of these devices, and they're kind of expensive, coupled with COVID-19, has made some surgeries especially dangerous, as you can imagine. Now an unlikely ally for these health workers, oil field workers. With the downturn in the oil industry, Chris Payson and his team at the Jacksboro, Texas-based oil field services company Reach Wireline put some extra time to good use, building more than half a dozen containment boxes for local hospitals. And now, plans are underway to make more for healthcare workers across the U.S.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Small businesses dealing with the dramatic drop in cash flow thought they would have a quick $10,000 in federal assistance to survive the pandemic. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports that for many, the program initially set up for natural disasters hasn't been helping them weather this disaster.
David Lee owns Blue Moon Construction. They do specialty land clearing for property owners in St. Petersburg, Florida. He opened in 2006 and a couple years later made it through the Great Recession. In a time when 80% of his industry closed, he prided himself on never missing any of his payments. But now, in the midst of another historic unemployment and economic crisis, it feels different.
We started seeing some weakness in sales in early March. And, it's like staring into oblivion.
So Lee, along with more than a million other businesses across the country, applied for an Emergency Injury Disaster Loan, or EIDL. Historically, the program has helped natural disaster victims like those from Hurricane Harvey. When the $2 trillion CARES Act passed, it expanded the program and added an advance of up to $10,000 for businesses. And unlike the Paycheck Protection Program, which is focused on keeping employees on the books, this money could be used for rent and bills right away. The money was required by the law to be in people's bank accounts within 3 days. Lee was hopeful.
We had projected $10,000 would get us through June 15th.
But the money hasn't showed up, and the Small Business Administration changed how it would be doled out. Now each business would be allotted $1,000 per employee. So now instead of 10, he was looking at $2,000, which he says wouldn't really help.
That is going to severely impact our ability to cover our operational costs and meet our equipment loans. It's a nail in the coffin for small companies.
And that assumes these businesses get any money. A recent post on Reddit got more than 100 comments from people saying they haven't heard anything from SBA, not even a confirmation email.
No email or call, or there's no place to put in a confirmation number on the website and check status.
Kim Yonke runs a series of retail stores in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. They've been closed since March 20th in this town that's more ghost than tourist at this point. She says she tried calling the local SBA, but no one picked up.
I think you have a lot of really terrified, desperate, angry people and who can't get any help, and the businesses who can't pay their landlords, who can't pay their banks, who can't pay, I think it's a chain reaction. The domino starts right here with the small businesses.
Ted Langley's a certified public accountant in Spanish Fort, Alabama, outside Mobile. All last week, he helped neighbors and friends file for EIDL, and they still keep coming.
I bought lunch, brought it back, and I never got the bite, the first french fry, before I already had 2 phone calls from people asking me about the EIDL program.
He estimates he helped 50 area businesses file so far. None have seen any advance money, and he isn't sure they will.
It's the worst mess I've ever seen in my life.
Congress set the 3-day limit for the SBA. four senior Democratic lawmakers sent a letter expressing concern about the delay in the money getting to businesses. The Small Business Administration wouldn't comment for this story, but a recent tweet from the SBA Massachusetts office said, quote, "Frustration out there is understandable. Rome wasn't built in a day," end quote. The tweet committed to getting the advance money out under the new lower terms this week. It was later deleted. Despite the troubled rollout of both EIDL and the PPP, it isn't clear that everyone in the government is on the same page. Here's President Donald Trump Saturday talking about the federal response.
Yeah, they're behind. They're not behind. It's been flawless so far, far beyond our expectations.
Saying that this rollout has been flawless is just insulting.
Again, David Lee.
It's really insulting. And, we're the guys who are out there every day, and we were overlooked.
For many businesses, the delayed response has left them feeling abandoned, and any response may come too late. I'm Paul Flavin, San Antonio.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about, and I see that Texans have quite a lot to say about the issue of mail-in voting.
That sure is right. Yeah, we were talking about this earlier, the topic of voting through the mail gaining steam in light of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Folks unsure how long it's going to last, whether or not it could even impact our November elections. So yeah, this has been a topic that lots of folks have been piping up about lately, prompted in large part by President Trump and his comments at those daily coronavirus briefings where he's basically attacked the prospect, even though he did admit himself that I think he requested an absentee ballot. So we've been reaching out to our friends and listeners on social media for their perspectives, and yeah, tons of reactions. Here's one from Twitter from Cornell Woolridge. He says, "We conduct so much sensitive business by mail, from renewing licenses to paying credit card bills, that I can't see how we aren't able to find a way to vote by mail. During this age of COVID-19, a person shouldn't have to risk death just to vote." David, I'm reminded of some of those incredible scenes I believe we saw out of Wisconsin, the primary election there this week, where people lined up, although, you know, in some cases socially distanced with masks on, all lined up there to vote. Colin B. White has another interesting suggestion via Twitter. He says, "I'd rather try to find a way to vote online securely. It seems like a good application of blockchain, that technology they're used to encrypt Bitcoin." Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Greg Glinter says, "Five states already have vote by mail, including Oregon, which had 63% voter turnout in 2018, compared with 46% in Texas. Isn't participation what really makes it a democracy?" So lots of opinions out there about how to proceed going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the big stories I think that people are going to be talking about, certainly they've already been talking about it, but it's, you were mentioning this last time we were chatting, 6.6 million new people on the jobless rolls. That is a staggering number when you put it all together. It's like 16 million people, and that over the span of like 3 weeks. It's kind of hard to understand or evaluate the sort of economic cliff that the nation has fallen off of in just that short period of time. And I think still a lot of people still trying to come to terms with what it all means in the aggregate, but a lot of people feeling pain, personal pain right now.
No, definitely so. I mean, like you said, it's really hard to sort of grasp it. You know, one thing I've seen on social media on Twitter today are some graphs sort of plotting this in perspective. And it's just completely staggering. We've never seen an increase like we're seeing today. It's everything just sort of, it blunts every previous reporting period, just seeing the numbers that are up there today. You know, a lot of things are up for sort of a discussion and reevaluation. You know, we get emails from time to time from our listeners as well. They can email us at texasstandard@kt.org. And one, David King He passes along this note from a friend of his, a doctor at a Houston area hospital. Mm-hmm. He writes that there's a lot of confusion and a lot of political ranting about people using or recommending unproven and or experimental drugs to treat illness.
Right.
We need to remember that this is a disease never encountered in humans before. That's why it's called the novel coronavirus. A real fascinating perspective from a doctor there, sort of saying this is an all hands on deck situation and now isn't the time to dismiss new options out of hand.
Very interesting perspective. We need to hear yours, Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about. We're keeping an eye on what's making news across the Lone Star State. You can keep up with it at texasstandard.org. Till tomorrow, take care of yourself.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.